Kadosh. Remember, remember, Adonai Eloheinu.
Welcome to Romamu, an open-hearted Jewish community and house of worship, learning, and spiritual growth. You're listening to Romamu's podcast, where we share words of Torah, insights, and inspiration from Romamu clergy. Thank you for being with us.
This week's Torah portion, Parsha of the Week, brings us one of the most famous stories in the Bible, and for that matter, maybe of all Western literature. Known as the Akedah, or the Binding of Isaac, chapter 22 of the book of Genesis, tells the horrific story of an obedient Abraham dutifully fulfilling God's command to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac. Over the generations, communities and commentators have found in this story contradictory messages. Some interpreted Abraham's actions as heroic and some as reprehensible. But all who read it could not forget the pained father leading his beloved, long-longed-for and promised son to the slaughter. The story touches upon the most basic questions and relationships all at once. Duty and responsibility, parents and children, God and country, husband and wife, faith and loyalty, laughter and tears. And therefore, as my dear friend Rabbi Mishael Tzion wrote, any reading of the Akedah necessarily puts forward an entire ideology. Tell me how you understand the Akedah, and I will tell you what your most basic beliefs are. I might add that interpretation itself shifts from day to day. Tell me what you understand in the Akedah today, and then tell me again tomorrow, and I'll know that you're holding multiple perspectives and ideologies, depending on the moment that we find ourselves in. So tonight I'd like to offer two interpretations of the Akedah. The first interpretation will emerge from, I think, a new reading of Abraham's encounter with God in chapter 18 of the book of Genesis. And the second one is not new at all, but really important. So let's begin with how most of us read the Akedah and go from there. For many of us as moderns, myself included, the Akedah is a story, as I said earlier, of a religious fanatic who in his God intoxication, to borrow a term from Daniel Hartman, loses all sense of morality and ethics. I know that at a time of legitimate disdain for religious fundamentalism that we live in today, that interpretation of the Akedah is the most appealing of all, isn't it? We moderns find the Akedah abhorrent because it seems to dangerously separate religion from ethics. Answering Euthyphro's famous question, is an action ethical because God commands it, or does God command it because it is ethical, with a straightforward answer, because God commands it. That's what makes it abhorrent. God commands it, and therefore it's ethical. We ourselves reserve the right to have a meta-ethical stance vis-a-vis all sacred text. Daniel Hartman, as I quoted earlier, Rabbi Daniel Hartman wrote a book called Putting God Second, because when religious fanatics of every tradition see God as first, as the ultimate author of what is ethical and arbiter of what is ethical, perversions occur. All religious traditions are implicated when Abraham acquiesces to the perverse command of God. And we who live in the aftermath of Auschwitz know all too well the carnage that blind obedience to authority creates. Often our despair and dissonance, though, with the God-intoxicated Abraham can be located in one specific feature of the narrative. And it begins in chapter 18, and it's in the chasm that separates Abraham of Genesis 18 with Genesis 22 that many of us find our deepest problem. It's one thing for the God of Genesis or any God to say, do what is unethical, do what is abhorrent, but how could Abraham not protest? Abraham argues in chapter 18 with God over the collective punishment of Sodom and Gomorrah. He argues with God and tells him, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, the judge of all the earth shall not act justly. And in that moment, Abraham became known as the great arguer with God, a long-standing tradition that will repeat itself over and again with Moses and with other prophets. Abraham shows himself able to stand up to God's power and authority without wincing. And in that moment, Abraham sets the bar for himself. And yet in chapter 22, Abraham silently and obediently says, "Here I am, God," when God asked for Isaac. Where was Genesis 18? So maybe when we understand, when we read Genesis 18 as a moment of moral clarity from Abraham and courageous leadership, maybe we need to read it or read chapter 22 differently, actually, than the way that we've been reading it. Perhaps Genesis 18 informs Genesis 22 in ways that we don't often ask. Perhaps Abraham learned from his argument with God and his subsequent inability to locate the requisite righteous individuals to trust God even more deeply. Or perhaps Abraham never looked for the righteous that he himself had longed to find. The text doesn't tell us he looked for them. Perhaps Abraham realized none of those things. Perhaps Abraham, in the end, had two very different standards, one for the world and one for his own family. Maybe chapter 22, where Abraham refuses to argue with God for his own family, is a moment where Abraham's own morality mirrors, unfortunately, much of what I've discovered and many of my colleagues have discovered over the last three some odd weeks, and that many of us have been speaking about for a long time. With each passing moment in this ever tragic and terrifying war, old assumptions and hidden stratagems are being investigated. We're learning so much so quickly now that there's simply no time to fully digest it all. And one general theme emerges for me in each community I find myself in each conversation I have, in each article that I read. Israel, the Jewish people, must express a universalism that others are not held to. We demand that of ourselves more than we are willing to demand it from others. In other words, we are willing to sacrifice ourselves before we would dare argue for our own kin, our own particularity, our own identity. This is a jarring realization. Abraham, not able to argue for his own children. And we say, where is the Abraham of chapter 18? Where has the courage gone? Abraham was able to march for Black Lives Matter. Abraham was able to march for feminism. Abraham was able to march when it came to every imaginable injustice. But when it came to his own family and his own truth, when it came to his own particularism, Abraham was wholly righteous. Whatever you want, God, I won't fight with you. Who can imagine Abraham on the couch? Is it some version of Hebrew self-hatred? Is Abraham someone who was so embarrassed by his own family, asks of it more than he would ask of anyone else? How often have many of us over the last three some odd weeks been wondering, how is it possible to read the things that we're reading? Over and over again, asking ourselves. And maybe it's because we don't know what it's like really to be in Israel this moment. Maybe because we're so distant from it and we get our news and our experience from the tube and from Twitter and from Facebook and from CNN and from, you name it, New York Times. Maybe we don't know the dark cloud that has descended upon each and everyone who lives in the state of Israel this moment. Just this past week, friends sent pictures yet again of another funeral for an entire family. How is it even possible to have a conversation with people about justice when the a priori assumption is that our justice, the justice for the Jewish people, is set at a standard that no one else must live by? If you're thinking to yourself, wow, there's going to be another concert tomorrow night for the hostages, if even the thought arose in your brain, should we also include all of the innocent civilians in Gaza in that concert? Guess what? I'm sorry, because I have that thought too. It's a crazy thought. It's a thought that would never, ever emerge in other contexts except within the Jewish community. Not to say that we shouldn't pray for innocence, God forbid. Not to say that our community should not, of course, beat our standards for Torah Neshek, for the morality of the army. Of course, all of those things are true. But where would the thought even arise? There are 230-some-odd hostages who are Jewish. And the first inclination of our universal heart is it okay for us just to pray for our own? I work at an institution that thinks that way, not here, but somewhere else. Will people be offended if we only pray for Jews? There are so many mosques in New York City. Has anybody knocked on a mosque and said, are you also praying for the hostages? And I don't say this from a place of anger. I hope you don't hear anger. Do I sound angry to you? I'm not angry. A little bit angry? Well, that's good feedback. Wow. And it is okay to be angry, but I'm not angry. So thank you so much. I'm passionate. Thank you. I got to calm down. Thank you so much. Any other stage direction also is also welcome at this moment. How's the Stender going? Should I like, you know, is it okay? So I just wanted to hear, I want you to hear it in the way that I intended. That's why I asked how I'm coming across, because I don't always, when you're talking, you don't know. I'm not angry at that per se. I just want to lift it up and see it. I want to have the courage to see that moment, not because I want to fight with anyone. I want a world where there is no death of innocent civilians. There's not a person I know that doesn't dream of that and want that deeply. But I want to expose and see for it in clear ways, the ways that we unconsciously and unknowingly allow ourselves to participate in our own, in the memes and the frames and the assumptions that limit us and call us in ways that are frankly unjust and unfair. I can't help but read people that I love and revere even, who are now in the progressive world changing their voices so radically from 3 weeks ago and yet still maintaining these double standards. Just one great rabbi, well known throughout the liberal Jewish community, wrote something this week and sent it out, in which he said very differently than he said in the first week of the conflict, of the war. He said, I don't have an answer. Israel must defend itself even at the cost of innocent civilians. It has its obligation to its own citizens. Now I get it. He had spoken differently about it in the first 2 weeks. But let's say, he said, let's talk about the context, he said. And then immediately there was a qualification. Of course, there is no context that can justify what took place on October 7th, he said, and then waited a paragraph, and then proceeded to give a context. I don't know if anybody else has read things like that, where people say, oh, there is no context, and then you wait a couple of lines, and they say, well, but it's impossible to go forward without giving a context. And then the context inevitably says how Israel is responsible for everything that's happening, because it had moral capital after the Second World War and squandered it in 1967, some such things. And here's what I know. All of these conversations begin with the assumption of Israel and Jewish guilt. And so I would love to leave open the space to rectify Abraham's sin when he didn't argue with God for his own family, to rectify that sin in the current moment, in the current Akedah, in the current binding of Isaac, that we feel proud to be Jewish, that we feel proud to have a homeland, that we recognize its flaws and its faults, but at this moment, we don't stir when feeling guilty because we don't have enough empathy to include every human being that is suffering at this moment on the planet and to have a family, and it is our family. And this brings me to my last interpretation of the Akedah, and I said it's not new. The interpretation of the Akedah that isn't new is that Abraham becomes the paragon of someone willing to heed a higher calling, even if it means giving away that which can never be replaced. And in this interpretation, Abraham is not at fault for not arguing. Abraham shows remarkable loyalty and an ability to self-transcend for the sake of a higher calling. For many of us, right, that story and its lesson of ultimate sacrifice for something that is much bigger than ourselves is actually happening on the ground. That story of heeding a command to give up something precious because God or Jewishness or our ancestors or our people have demanded of us is meeting our real and lived experience of anti-Semitism here and around the globe. In the face of public declarations of Jew hatred, no longer hidden behind legitimate critique of Israel's policies, global intifadas, we are ourselves faced with the danger our Jewishness presents each and every day. Everywhere I go, people are asking themselves whether to remove their yarmulkes, their Star of David, take their mezuzah off the door, or even change their name. And the great Hanna Senish, the Hungarian Israeli poet who volunteered to paratroop into Nazi Europe to save Jewish lives, only to be captured and murdered, wrote, "There are events without which one's life becomes unimportant, a worthless toy, and there are times when one is commanded to do something even at the price of one's life." This week, this interpretation of Abraham's story is our story and our test. We Jews have hidden from physical threats before, and we've hidden our Jewishness, our Jewish identity, when our Jewishness was perceived as a hindrance to our own ambitions in an unfriendly non-Jewish world. And so accommodation and acculturation and appeasement and assimilation have always been our survival tools, used and then misused throughout our history. But it is time this Shabbat to say no to those double standards, to not cower behind veils of acceptance from a world that equivocates on whether to call the murder of Jewish babies evil, even as it ironically and absurdly reminds Israel to act ethically in defending itself against present and future dangers. It is time to not only refuse to give a context to the attack on October 7th, but refuse to do so even after saying that there are no contexts that we can offer to explain radical evil. It is time for all of us as Jews, in face of danger and threat, to double down on our Jewishness, to be proudly Jewish. So I end this hopefully not too angry Devar Torah. When people ask me how things are, and of course all of us have our answers, and how do you, like, what do you say at this moment? And of course, I think a lot of us, as I said last week in last week's sermon, are struggling with our universal impulse and our particular affinity with the Jewish people. And my answer going forward is, how am I? I'll say I'm crying. I'm crying for Israel. I'm crying for innocent life lost, innocent Palestinians, innocent Israelis, Jews everywhere. This is Yehuda Amichai's poem on the Akedah, a third and surprising interpretation. Avram had three sons, not just two. Avram had three sons, Yishmael, Yitzchak, and Yivkeh. Yivkeh means he will cry. No one has ever heard of Yivkeh, for he was the youngest and the most beloved, who was sacrificed on Har HaMoriah. Yishmael was saved by his mother Hagar, Yitzchak saved by the angel, but Yivkeh, he will cry, was not saved by anyone. When he was young, his father would call him in love, Yivkeh, Yivkeh, little Yivkeh, my sweetie. But he sacrificed him in the Akedah. And in the Torah it says a ram, but it was Yivkeh. Yishmael never again heard about God the rest of his life. Yitzchak never again laughed the rest of his life. And Sarah only laughed once and never again. Avram had three sons, Yishma, Yitzchak, Yivkeh, the one who heard God, the one who laughed with God, and the one who cried. Yishmael, Yitzchak-el, Yivkeh-el, the one who heard God, the one who laughed with God, and God will cry.
Thank you for listening. Want more content like this? Subscribe to our podcast and visit romamu.org to learn more about us. Please consider making a contribution to Romamu so we can continue to fulfill our mission to help spiritual seekers deepen their connection to Jewish wisdom and practice to help them become more compassionate human beings. We hope to see you in the synagogue or the Zoomagogue soon. Romamu, Romamu, Adonai.